understanding of the environment. And the second is a loss of confidence in one's ability to overcome challenges.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. And here are some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning, the recitation of the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we'll listen to the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start this hour's lineup with the Ocean of Dua, which gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books, such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamelu Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will follow next. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Allahumma inna narghabu ilayka fi dawlatin kareema تعز بها الإسلام وأهله وتذل بها وتجعلنا فيها من الدعاة إلى طاعتك والقادة إلى سبيلك، وترزقنا بها كرامة الدنيا والآخرة.
Oh Allah, we are ardently desire that in the kind, just and fair government, you give honor to Islam and its followers, and humble and humiliate hypocrisy and hypocrites, and include us among those who invite people into your obedience and lead them to your approved path, and give us the good of this world and the world to come. Previously, we have talked about different parts of this supplication and dua, but in this one, we are trying to talk about the topic of waiting for the advent of Imam Mahdi. May the Almighty Allah hasten his auspicious advent. A part of this dua says, Allahumma inna narghabu ilayka fi dawlatin kareemah. O Allah, we are ardently desire that in the kind, just and fair government, tu'izzu biha al-Islam wa ahla, you give honor to Islam and its followers, wa tudhillu biha al-nifaq wa ahla, and humble and humiliate hypocrisy and hypocrites. وَتَجْعَلُنَا فِيهَا مِنَ الدُّعَاتِ إِلَىٰ طَاعَتِكَ, and include us among those who invite people into your obedience. وَالْقَادَةِ إِلَىٰ سَبِيلِكَ, and lead them to your approved path. وَتَرْزُقُنَا بِهَا كَرَامَةَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ, and give us the good of this world and the world to come. So as you can see, this point is highlighted here, and it is the desire for Islamic State to be established with the reappearance of Hazrat Wali Asr Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. In this supplication, the mission of the Islamic government and our duty in relation to it are also mentioned and talked about. Fortunately, we're all encompassed by God's favor of the knowledge about Hadrat Wali Asr and waiting for his advent. Belief in the advent of Hadrat Mahdi is common to all Muslim schools of thought. Also, non-Muslims believe in a sort of waiting for relief with the coming of a savior. With our Sunni brothers, we have only a few differences concerning the belief in the coming of Hadrat Mahdi, may Almighty Allah hasten his auspicious advent. Many Sunni scholars have written books about Hadrat Mahdi alayhi salam, and acknowledge that their recorded traditions, those ahadith, about Imam Mahdi are mutawatir. However, there are differences of opinion about his personal features. Some Sunnis believe that at the end of a time, a descendant of the Apostle sallallahu alaihi wasallam named Mahdi will come, but they differ with us on the identity of his partners. Anyway, the question we have to ask from ourselves is this, that what is our motive in waiting for the Imam of the age? Why are we waiting for that government of truth? And what incites your desire to be present during his advent? And one more important question, what is our duty during this period of waiting or intidhar? What must we do so as to be included among those who are truly waiting for him? The carnal state of a man is so complex that he himself sometimes is unaware of its intricacies. Sometimes a person wants something without knowing the reason behind the inclination to it. So, regarding the issue of waiting for the advent of Hadrat Mahdi and the establishment of his government, people have also diverse motives. You may have noticed that it is popular among the layman that during the advent of Imam, the daily needs of man will be provided gratuitously, or what is called salawati. In other words, the needs which require efforts to be met will be met by only invoking blessings upon Muhammad and his progeny, salawatullah salamu alayhi. As such, it is possible that for this, or maybe for similar reasons, some people are eager to wait for the reappearance of the Imam of the age, Ajallallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and basically for this reason, they're waiting for it. Others are waiting for his coming to set right their affairs and remove the burden of problems from their shoulders.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
The fact is that it is not easy to perform some religious duties, especially social responsibilities, such as enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil, and campaigning against injustice and corruption, thinking that with the coming of Mahdi, these burdens will be removed from their shoulders. Some people are waiting for his reappearance. Perhaps on account of suffering from tyranny and oppression, others are waiting for the establishment of the government that will eliminate the tyrants, and then everyone will enjoy his right. Meanwhile, there are also so many people who are waiting for the advent of Hazrat Mahdi, for the victory of the religion of truth. Some are waiting for the implementation of the divine laws, which are yet to be implemented, and some are waiting for him for the annihilation of the traces of disbelief and polytheism. But we better ask ourselves, what is our motive in waiting for the advent of the Imam of Age? We'll try to answer that question in the next program. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery to face dreadful events. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt.
seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice. Our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. Thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? Not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late.
Welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General Raphael Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate, and the agency, Atomic International Atomic Agency, is one of our key partners, because as you might know, we created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the decision to build the new nuclear power plant till the finishing of its and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're very helpful for them, for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it, you are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more, such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural. I think as soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant, modern technology, the highest level of security. You know, for Belarus, we are very vulnerable in that sense because we've had a tragedy in 1986 in Chernobyl, and Belarus was severely contaminated by the radiation after that. So for some years, we had to persuade people that peaceful and very modern and very secure atomic energy can bring substantial results for the economy. As I mentioned, the energy consumption is growing each and every year. People, the regular citizens, they buy more and more electro cars, more and more public transportation means is driven by the electricity. We started developing the mining capacities for cryptocurrency, and we're looking for the data center creation. Belarus is a developed IT country that puts a lot of attention to that sector. Well, that's why we see the trend and we follow it just.
You mentioned the constructive cooperation with the IAEA in regards to peaceful nuclear energy, but at the same time, we've witnessed in particular the last 2 years heated debates here in this building, here in Vienna, at the Board of Governors meetings, at the General Conference of the IAEA, in relation to ongoing armed conflicts around the world, both in Middle East, West Asia, and in Eastern Europe. Two of your neighboring countries, Russia and Ukraine, are at war at the moment. And there is debate on security of nuclear plants in Ukraine, also in the Kursk region. There are regular attacks in the vicinity of these nuclear plants. How do you see the role of the IAEA in these conflicts?
IAEA has the highest ever reputation in that sphere and represents a big majority of countries that have the atomic capacities on their territory, and they know that security in that sphere is crucial. So in the ongoing conflict, I think, and you've heard that on the conference, President suggested that we should introduce a ban for the attacks on critical infrastructure objects, and we should protect them properly, and we should mobilize the support of the international community, meaning the protection. I meant also the ban for imposing sanctions on the industries, countries that utilize the atomic energy, because that might bring to some shortages of spare parts or some technologies that are crucially sufficient and necessary for providing the security. So definitely capacities, atomic capacities, should be duly protected, and because the explosion on them could easily bring to the situation that we've had on the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and in any other countries, and this could contaminate vast territories, big territories in Europe. So for our own security, we should do a lot and persuade the international community, and the International Atomic Agency could do a good job in that, persuading their members to refrain from attacking the NPPs.
Which is actually the statute of the IAEA, but still in June, such attacks happened. The US and Israel attacked Iranian sites, nuclear sites. In reaction to that, unfortunately, Director General Gross refused to condemn these attacks. And at the General Conference in September, a resolution had been tabled by Russia, China, and Iran, and also supported by your country, Belarus, to refrain from these attacks. How do you see the situation now that even in the 21st century, it is still necessary to table a motion that says we are against attacks on peaceful nuclear facilities?
I think that we are still a little bit far from getting the long-standing solution for that. But I can only confirm that Belarus will support each and every effort that will bring more protection, more security, and more peace, even if there is some dispute or conflict appears. We were following attentively. I think many people, many politicians in our region and outside were worried about the situation which took place in Iran. And I think that exactly not by weapons, not by means of military forces, any obstacles, any disputes could be solved. This is the job of the international employees, international agencies, politicians and diplomats. And that's what we are interested to do. We do believe in a classical diplomacy without fakes, without assaults, attacks on each other. That's what we see now on the OEC premises in the United Nations. People sometimes blame secretariats of these organizations for not providing a proper assistance or just infrastructure or getting some events which would suit them. But, you know, I would like to draw your attention that the secretariats, they just serve the countries. And the atmosphere which is now in Vienna, in Geneva, in New York, and in other European and world capitals is just like this, like the countries are representing themselves on these sides. So we have to start, and we've talked about that with Director General of the Atomic Agency, that we do believe that politicians from countries active in that sphere, in the sphere of security, in atomic energy, in the conflict settlement, they will be more polite and they will be more constructive in discussing modern challenges.
And you just mentioned the OSCE, that was, so to say, the second purpose of your visit to Vienna, the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE that took place here in Vienna this week. And I followed the conference very closely. I listened to the speeches over the past 2 days, and listening to the speeches, the constant attacks both on Belarus and Russia from every single minister, delegate, and representative. One might wonder, why are you attending the OSCE conference in such an atmosphere?
Because we do believe in the spirit of Helsinki. We believe in the force of real classical diplomacy. We do believe in the future of this organization, which can be a very effective instrument in for the conflict settlement. That's what it has been designed for. You're absolutely right. What we see in Hofburg recent years, is just the throwing to each other the national statements. But unlike many other countries from Europe and other regions, we each and every time try to persuade our partners, try to find the solutions, try to mobilize the support, try to find the not politically biased topics that we could discuss in smaller groups, in a some formats that are not non-discriminatory for other participants. And I think what we are now lacking at the OSCE premises is the talks about the participation of Russia and security for Russia. Because what has started in Ukraine, it was the lack of security for Russia itself, with the NATO expansion, with the collapse of Soviet Union, with the collapse of the international architecture, with the collapse of the spirit of Helsinki that brought people from different countries with different views to the same table, which finalized with the final act, Helsinki Final Act in 1975. So I do believe in the power and force of diplomacy, and I hope we will shortly bring to an end to that conflict, and we will restore the trust and enhance the confidence building measures.
But as I said, listening to the speech and also following other international organizations, one becomes very pessimistic that this approach is even possible. Instead of what you said, the spirit of Helsinki in 1975, the idea of closing the gap between different blocs, presenting a space for dialogue, now we see a clear split in all international organizations, the introductions of sanctions against states, just like your state, but also other states, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and the so-called sanctions regime from the West is tightening. How you assess, in general, the Eurasian security architecture at the moment?
Well, I think that we should bring the security issues in a broader context than Europe itself. We should expand it to the whole continent, Eurasian continent, and that's what we are doing regularly in Minsk since already 3 years. The newest edition of the conference took place in October, end of October in Minsk, and it every year it gathering more and more participants. We enhance the level of political participants from different countries, and we try to attract as many attention as we can, transforming this event to the unlike-minded event. We're not seeking support and looking only for our friends. We're also inviting those who will not support us, but they will understand our motivation, our efforts, and will someday they will bring some also support and income to that format. I do agree with you that the situation is far from ideal, from being too peaceful, but if we stop talking, if we close the doors, we will bring the world and the region to the war, the global war, or to the full-scale war in the region. That's what we don't want to do. And our intention is not to make everyone agree with us. The intention was to make everyone understand what we need, and we could also understand the intentions of the other side. That brings, because the war is being often starts when people don't talk to each other and they don't understand each other. This misunderstanding it enhances the level of conflict potential. Conference is a good format. You participated in that, and I think you felt the atmosphere of Minsk spirit, so to say, and we will continue. We are not substituting OSCE in any case. OSCE is an international organization where we could do the three traditional baskets, our cooperation, and the conference is the awareness building, is the spreading of information, and gaining support from countries that are worried by the problems in Eurasian security. Well, you've seen the number of participants from big Eurasia, from different countries, from different analytics reviewers and specialists in international relations. I like this atmosphere we've created, and I do believe that we will go further, because it has become an annual event.
By strengthening Eurasian security at the same time, when you look at the Western media, the Western politicians, they accuse Belarus of undermining European security. Very often you hear this example of using migrants to undermine Western European security. What do you say to this argument?
Well, we don't use anyone. Migrants trying to cross the border illegally via our territory because they are desperate about the situation in their countries of origin, and they use our territory to get to a better life. But what they see on the border, they see the cruel pushbacks, they see the unwelcome approach from the authorities of the neighboring countries, they don't see any even procedures, refugees procedures or asylum seekers procedures. They don't see the, and they, are being disappointed, and we see less and less those poor people on our borders. We try to persuade our partners that we should return to the format of building shelters for those people. We should do something to improve situations in their countries of origin. And Belarus is very much engaged in that process. You've noticed probably the visits of our president or our prime minister or our minister of foreign affairs to Asian countries, to African countries, where we create jobs, where we supply our technologies and equipment. And that brings more trust, more confidence, and we are happy that our turnover is increasing in food and products and machinery and so on. So I think that the illegal migration is a problem that we could combat on together. And just throwing the claims on some countries, that doesn't help to change the situation for the best. So we call upon international community and our neighbors and countries of origin of those migrants to sit and see together what could be done to improve the situation. Commenting your remarks on the Eurasian security, I would like to know that the main problem mostly lays that some parties want to win, but we all win if the war will not start. That will be the win. We should not collapse or bring some countries to collapse as they did with the Soviet Union. On the political map of Europe, each and every country today presents a guarantee that something bad will not happen, that the military conflict will not break out. You see what happened in Ukraine. That's because of lack of confidence and lack of security granted for all countries. You cannot be secured if you bring insecurity to your neighbors. So the neighborhood, we consider the neighborhood is the main asset that we have to share and we have to preserve with all our neighbors. And I mentioned that numerously on the OSCE premises. We don't want to see the NATO at our borders. We want to see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. As in the sense of neighborhood, it's vital for us.
At the same time, you mentioned avoiding a war. The world is moving into a new direction towards a multipolar world. The North American domination is clearly coming to an end, but particularly the European Union is unwilling to accept it. We recently see the introduction of the Rearm Europe program, conscription in France, in Germany, building massive armies. They even talk about we need to go to war against Russia. How can a war actually be avoided?
Well, the war can be avoided with the perception that it will bring no victory to some separate countries. This will bring blood, victims, destructed infrastructure. Unfortunately, those who rearm their armies and enhance the level of militarization, they have forgotten about the pain and tragedy that war has brought to their countries. And I think that I do believe that we don't need a new war to understand that, because war is very expensive, very unpredictable, and it will economically it's not efficient means of solving the problems. The only efficient way, maybe longer than the military conflict, but longer but very stable and will bring more profit when we sit and again discuss things instead of militarize, put money, pump money into the military budgets and enhance the military industry and enhance the army, because it's not economically necessary, and it will bring the traditional spheres of the economy to a collapse.
But at the same time, we see increasingly a move of some states to work outside the international law framework, United States, Israel, with their attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, breaking international law, and these attacks had no consequences for these countries, no consequences at the UN Security Council. How can international rule-based order re-established?
You know, the architecture, international architecture, and the rule of law has been not destroyed, but in a bad shape at the moment. I agree with you. How could we restore that? By restoring confidence, by restoring trust, by showing each other that we respect international law, which has been created by many generations before us. And we should create new mechanisms that will help to build, rebuild it, that and restore that trust and confidence. I do agree with you that the secretariats of international organizations, often monopolized by certain countries' representatives, that don't want to talk about any appeasement, any peaceful solution on different matters. And what the Security Council, as I mentioned, reflects the current state of the intergovernmental relations. So sooner or later, I believe in the force of diplomacy, we will sit and decide that, because many countries that are trying to support a military operation in Ukraine, they realize that their communities are lacking something very substantial: social standards, the energy tariffs, the cost of living is not as it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that the policymakers should realize that they are specifically designed and brought to their positions not to start the wars, but to finish, end up the conflicts, and to settle problems, and make their best to enhance the standard of living for their population, for their communities. People are against the war, that's evident, but on the West, they are frightened, they are scared by every day's information reports saying that one country is an aggressor, somebody there is their supporters, and so on. But, you know, this is today's everyday's routine, unfortunately. But I do believe that the glass is more than half full than empty. So we are doing, you know, with our colleagues, a lot of job at the moment to find right formats and right solutions in the sphere of international relations and in our region. And the topic number one on my desk every day is the security issues, situation on the border, and relations with the neighbors.
And final question, coming back to the Third Eurasian Security Conference in Minsk, really high profile conference if you look at the participants, contrary to the OSCE meeting in Vienna at the moment. We saw personal participation of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We saw high profile representation from many other countries like China, Hungary, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. But I'm wondering how this conference and the debate and discussions at this conference can be turned into practice to strengthen Eurasian security.
It's already been transferred into a practice, because as a follow-up, we see the numerous consultations between the ministries. We see the interaction of analytical community. We continue the meetings in smaller formats of representatives that were part of our conference. We see the articles, and we see the effects in more predictable and friendly relations between countries participating on that conference. We see new perspectives for the trade turnover and economic relations. I think that the money spent to organize that conference, we've saved a lot of resources due to that event. More and more people do believe what they saw with their own eyes and do not believe in what they read or hear every day from TV or from internet. they see how country looks like, they see how people are living, and that even enhances the diplomatic efforts that we maintain every day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deputy Foreign Minister Igor Segreta. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us from the UN headquarters, the Vienna International Center, here on Face to Face, and goodbye for now.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Tehran is a megacity with a population of around 13 million people. It's a modern city with a modern architecture. Flats and high-rise buildings rule the whole city. From the outside, it's quite dense and all the houses look the same. But from the inside, well, let's go and see what makes the architecture of some of the buildings quite different from the rest. Some of the architects in the country, building a structure is not just about keeping up with the latest architectural trends. It's more about building a house that adapts with the functional needs of its users. Let's take a look at this one.
This is the Sharifiha House, a flexible structure with three turning boxes or rooms that can be rotated 90 degrees to open up the terrace during hot summers and turned back to a horizontal position to keep the house warmer during the cold, snowy winters. Ali Taghabouni is the mastermind behind the creation. He was inspired by the country's traditional houses, which offered both a winter and a summer living room for the residents.
We're going to see another house. It's basically a childhood dream come true, an eco-friendly house that will certainly blow your mind away.
A portable house made from wood and built in just 3 days, 72 pieces to be precise. 36 parts for the roof and 36 for the body, all fastened with screws. It's not one of the usual houses that you see each day. It's a house that connects you to nature and makes you feel calm and restful, undisturbed from the outside world. Abbas Iftikhari is the architect of this house, who has been living here with his family ever since it was built. He has studied industrial design, restoration of historic monuments, and interior design, and he has been teaching them all in the university for 18 years. Mr. Iftikhari told me that wood is a naturally grown and engineered material which contributes to an overall removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. At the same time, it's structurally strong and acts as a natural insulator due to the air pockets within its cellular structure. The family's sand clock was also interesting to see. Mr. Iftikhari explained to me that as the sun moves across the sky, the shadow aligns with different hour lines which are marked on the dial to indicate the time of the day. Every nook and corner of the house was also filled with different wooden sculptures, and as we understood, Abbas Iftikhari has a hand in sculpting too.
It's a dreamy experience, rubbing your hands on the different shapes of wood and smelling the woody fragrance and looking at the colorful, delicate veins as they each tell you their life story.
We live in a world constantly surrounded by technology. Maybe it's about time we got in touch with Mother Nature, becoming environmentally aware and reconnecting with the energy of the universe. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Nasir Khosrow Street is the oldest street in Tehran. It extends from Imam Khomeini Square to 15 Khordad Street in Tehran's Bazaar District. Along the way are some of the most iconic buildings and places of the capital, such as Darul Funun School, Saray Roshan, Shamsul Emare Building, and Marvi Alley.
Nasir Khosrow is more than just a street. You just need to walk from one end to another in order to travel to the past without even leaving the present. Join me in this historic journey.
The construction of Nasir Khosrow Street dates back to 1906. Before that date, the street was part of a large ditch in this area. After the construction of new trenches, they filled the ditch and it became Nasiriye Street, because it was built by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar.
The best way to know the central part of a city is to visit its historical places. Darul Funun School, the first modern school of Iran, which was founded in 1851 by Mirza Taqi Khan Amir Kabir.
Muhammad Taqi Amir Nizam, known as Amir Kabir, was the Prime Minister of Iran during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. During his time, Amir Kabir exercised administrative programs, cultural and economic reforms for the country. And certainly, his most important work was the foundation of Darul Funun. Darul Funun School played a major role in the process of modernization of Iran. Continue our journey on the road to the south. It is interesting that the first pharmacy, the first printing press, and the first school of Iran were all in this street. In its central section, most buildings date back to the early 20th century, and some of these historical buildings have been preserved.
Towards the middle of Nasir Khosrow Street, Saray Roshan rises as a historical symbol of this area. one of the first commercial buildings of the capital city. Its unique style is inspired by Gothic architecture.
Only 2 to 3 minutes walk from Saray Roshan, we find another unique building, which is called Shamsul Emare.
In this street, you can enjoy the architecture of a building called Shamsul Emare, or the Edifice of the Sun. Shamsul Emare is one of the most impressive structures of the Gulistan Palace, which was built around 150 years ago by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. I'm sure he had a perfect view of the city of Tehran when he was standing up there.
Shamsul Emare is the first five-story building in the capital, and at the time was considered the tallest building in Tehran. The building combines traditional Iranian architecture with European one. The facade of this building is decorated with bricks and colorful tiles with some beautiful paintings.
This Marvi Alley is located right across the street to Shamsul Emare building. Here you can find many different shops and boutiques for all different tastes and budgets. This part of the market attracts tourists and customers from different socioeconomic levels.
Marvi School is located in the same alley, and it is one of the oldest seminaries in Iran. This school was built almost about 200 years ago. The Marvi School is a 4,500 square meters space and has a capacity for about 200 students. The schoolyard is a square garden and it includes several rooms, a library consisting of old books, and a small pond in the middle. Before I say goodbye to this street, I'm going to try some street food here because Tehran's Bazaar district is famous for its tasty foods. I was told that the falafel sandwich of this area is just awesome. And indeed it is, so I hope you get a chance to try it too. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.